From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, could Russian troops be in eastern Ukraine? West Africa Ebola outbreak? U.S. and African countries tackling piracy in the Gulf of Guinea? Plus the passing of one of the world's oldest living professional baseball players. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Army paratroopers landed in Poland on Wednesday at the start of military maneuvers aimed at easing anxieties in allied Eastern European countries who are alarmed at Russia's annexation of Crimea. Bartłomiej Sienkiewicz is Poland's interior minister.
Oczywiście, że od pewnego czasu państwo polskie się przygotowuje na warianty najgorsze.
Nie he dlatego, said Poland is preparing for the worst scenarios. He said it's not because there is any tension on the Polish-Ukrainian border. The situation is calm there, he said. Nevertheless, we have to check the readiness of the Polish state, he says, for scenarios worse than now. U.S. troops landing came one day after Ukraine scrapped a truce and resumed its push against armed pro-Russian separatists occupying buildings in several Ukrainian cities near the Russian border. Moscow responded to the move with a warning that it will retaliate if the interests of Russian-speaking citizens in the region come under attack. Ukraine's decision to resume what it calls anti-terrorist operations came after the discovery of bodies of two Ukrainian patriots near the rebel-controlled city of Slovyansk. On Wednesday, pro-Russian forces in Ukraine admitted they were holding an American journalist, saying he was suspected of spying for Ukrainian ultranationalists. Simon Ostrovsky, a journalist for the Brooklyn-based Vice News, has not been seen since early Tuesday in the eastern city of Slovyansk. The fluent Russian speaker has been covering the crisis in Ukraine for weeks now and was reporting on the groups of mass gunmen seizing government buildings in one eastern Ukrainian city after another. Associated Press obtained parts of Ostrovsky's reporting for Vice News. In this clip, he talks about how the newly self-proclaimed People's Republic of Donetsk was barricaded inside of a building in downtown Donetsk.
It's day two of the People's Republic of Donetsk, and it smells like there was a huge frat party here because earlier today they decided to pour all their alcohol out onto the barricades out front because apparently there's been a problem with a little bit too much drinking.
Stella Horosheva, a spokesperson for the pro-Russian insurgents in Slovyansk, confirmed on Wednesday that Ostrovsky was being held at a local branch of the Ukrainian Security Service that gunmen seized more than a week ago. There is no time frame for when Ostrovsky's reports obtained by AP were voiced. In this report, he's apparently just come out of the building where the People's Republic of Donetsk are holed up.
That was the new administration of the Donetsk People's Republic, which is actually a very small country because it only exists inside the walls of the administration building and on the square out front.
Stella Horosheva said when asked why Ostrovsky was being captive, she said he's suspected of spying for a group called the Right Sector and for other enemy organizations, as she put it. In a statement released on Tuesday, Vice News said it was in contact with the U.S. State Department and other appropriate government authorities. And at the Wednesday State Department news briefing, spokesperson Jennifer Psaki was asked about the Ostrovsky detention.
I can express deep concern about the kidnapping of a U.S. citizen journalist in Slovyansk, Ukraine, reportedly at the hands of pro-Russian separatists. We have also raised our concerns with Ukrainian officials as they work with local authorities to try to de-escalate the security situation. We likewise condemn the taking of any hostages, including journalists in eastern Ukraine. We call for their immediate release and call on Russia to use its influence to ensure they are freed immediately.
Programs by Vice News, for whom Simon Ostrovsky works, are carried on the HBO TV network. There are an estimated 40,000 Russian troops stationed just across the border from Ukraine. But as VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshna reports, there are indications that some Russian troops are already on the Ukrainian side of the border.
Western experts say the Russian troops along the Ukrainian border are poised to invade that country if Russian President Vladimir Putin gives the order. But John Schindler, a specialist on intelligence at the U.S. Naval War College, says there is already one conflict going on, what he calls a special war.
That is a strategy for using power in a somewhat covert or clandestine manner, espionage, subversion, even terrorism, in a way that is not fully transparent, in a way that, you know, using overt military forces is very much what the Russians are doing in eastern Ukraine right now. They did it in Crimea before. They did a great deal of this in Georgia in 2008, leading up to their major military intervention.
Before Mr. Putin annexed Crimea last month, pro-Russian militia took over government buildings on the peninsula and asked for Moscow's support. Russian military authorities denied any links to the masked gunmen. Keir Giles heads the Conflict Studies Research Center, an organization that tracks the Russian military. He says there is no doubt Russian soldiers were on the peninsula at that time, despite attempts to make them anonymous.
They took off all of the unit patches and so on from the uniforms, but they were not all particularly careful about that, so some still had, for example, name tags attached to their body armor. Tracing those through Russian social media, you can work out exactly which unit they're from and find out that actually they departed for Crimea at the end of February.
Now that Crimea is in Russian hands, the focus has shifted to predominantly Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine. Russian officials are once again denying that Russian troops are in Ukraine. But Keir Giles says there is no doubt about their presence.
The Russian forces in Ukraine are making a much greater effort to be less obvious than they were in Crimea. So they're trying quite hard to look disorganized and less well-trained, and also intermingling much more effectively with the local units that are supporting them, as opposed to Crimea, when there were very distinct groups of Russian servicemen and the local mobs that were on their side.
John Schindler from the U.S. Naval War College says Russian forces have been in Ukraine for some time.
For weeks, there have been GRU, that is Russian military intelligence special operators, roaming around eastern Ukraine and also southern Ukraine. Some of them have been caught in the Odessa area as well. These are, you know, relatively small groups, 10, 20, 30 individuals in each group running around, raising local supporters, distributing guns, money, etc. This is exactly what GRU does. They're very good at it, and they've been laying the groundwork for this for some time.
Schindler and Giles say there is evidence that special forces that were in Crimea are now in eastern Ukraine. Schindler says Russian covert operations have increased under President Putin, a former Soviet KGB agent.
Putin has created a state where the intelligence services, which are his, of course, original base of power, have enormous influence on decision-making and strategy-making in a way that no Western state has.
And if you don't understand that, says Schindler, you don't understand how Moscow and the Kremlin operate today. Andre Dineshner, VOA News, Washington.
You can keep updated on the Ukraine crisis by going to our website, voanews.com. Still ahead, deadly blast in Nairobi.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and
civilians.
Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Police in Kenya's capital intercepted a suspicious car at a traffic light on Wednesday and were taking the occupants in for questioning when the car exploded, killing four people, including two police officers. This man witnessed what happened.
That was a blast at around 9. A level, the lights went off. And there was a tremor in this building.
Incidents like this have been of concern in Kenya in recent months, particularly after last September's attack on Westgate Mall that killed at least 67 people. Most of the small-scale attacks and explosions are blamed on Al-Shabaab, the militant group in Somalia that has vowed revenge attacks in Kenya because Kenyan troops moved into southern Somalia in 2011. A human rights group is urging Nigeria's government to do more to rescue the many teenage girls who are still missing after being abducted last week by Islamist extremists. A member of the group Baobab for Women's Human Rights said Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan should mobilize military planes to search for the girls. There have been no claims of responsibility, but the kidnappings are believed to have been carried out by the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram. A medical relief worker at an Ebola treatment center in Guinea says new patients continue to be admitted on a daily basis. Jonas Hagison of Doctors Without Borders says many of the people receiving treatment at the center in Conakry know how they were exposed.
A lot of the people who come into our centers, they actually know how they got infected because they have been in close contact with a person that they know had Ebola.
And in VOE interview, Hagison said medical relief workers are concerned about people who may be showing symptoms of the deadly virus but are not receiving treatment.
The concern is that the people who are sick, they actually get into the treatment center and that we make sure that we have all their contacts. That is the difficult part, to get people who believe that they're sick and they know that they had contact with somebody who had Ebola, that they actually come to our centers. And that we can get the whole picture of all those people that have been in contact with that person again. It's a huge, huge work, and it's very, very demanding.
At least 142 deaths from Ebola have been reported in Guinea and Liberia since the outbreak erupted in that region in February. Health officials are also investigating confirmed or suspected cases in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Three blocks of African countries and the United States have agreed to coordinate efforts to fight piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. Moki Edwin Kinzika has more from the site of the conference in Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And economic development. We say no shipping, no shopping. So we, along with...
Military personnel listen with sharp attention to senior officials of the U.S. military's Africa Command as they give a rundown of 40 vessels and people attacked by sophisticated armed gangs in the Gulf of Guinea this year. The epicenter of West African piracy, they say, is Nigeria, with 12 attacks and multiple kidnappings this year. Aboko Patrick, mayor of Komba Abedimu, a Cameroonian locality on the Bakassi Peninsula, tells VOA that the government of Cameroon negotiated his release when he and some friends were captured by pirates.
We were embarrassed with three gunboats armed to the teeth with about 10 persons per boat. They were gun firing. Some of us fell into water and were picked up by the pirates and taken to their camp. We were given indiscriminate beatings for close to about 6 hours. We sustained various injuries ranging from wounds and fractures.
Philip Hay, chief of the Air and Maritime Program of the U.S. Africa Command, says organized piracy is increasing because West African countries do not make maritime safety a priority.
The criminals are winning. Criminals act with impunity off of African waters. They fish illegally. They move illegal drugs, arms, weapons. They attack ships and shipping. And that has a very negative impact on trade for Africa and for economic development for Africa.
Professor Fonda Sikot, an economist at the University of Yaoundé, says trade and movements have been seriously hampered by pirate activities. He gives the example of Nigeria, which produces 2 million barrels of oil per day, but where oil tankers going abroad face the constant threat of hijacking and theft.
If the countries do not do something to stop that, it will be so difficult to ship or import anything, and without the ships being able to move freely because they are afraid of pirates and so on. You can imagine what that will mean to the economies, especially small economies like ours that depend a lot on that.
Philip Hay adds the current situation is causing harm to the economies of both Africa and developed countries.
Maritime trade is a shared interest. Every country has an interest. The U.S. is interested in keeping trade going. Cameroon is interested in keeping trade going. And that's why we use that expression, no shipping, no shopping.
This week's meeting in Yaoundé involved senior military officers from the Economic Community of West African States, the Economic Community of Central African States, and the Gulf of Guinea Commission. The officials and the U.S. Africa Command agreed to create a regional coordination center for maritime safety and also to arm it to face growing insecurity on the Gulf of Guinea. Cameroon Defense Minister Edgar Aleme Bengo says his country already has the facilities to host the center.
C'est véritablement l'institution qui va donc sur le plan opérationnel, sur le plan pratique.
It will be an institution to determine all operational and practical strategies against maritime insecurity, he says. The Gulf of Guinea Commission says countries on the Gulf supply around 40% of Europe's oil and 29% of petroleum products to the United States. It says without better maritime security, the region could become another Gulf of Aden, where Somali pirates ran wild for several years before international naval patrols shut them down. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Also in the news, President Obama began his first full day of a state visit to Japan today by meeting with Emperor Akihito at the Imperial Palace. He also meeting with the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Security concerns about China's territorial claims and North Korea's nuclear program will be the major focus of Mr. Obama's trip, which includes stops in Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Japan is embroiled in a growing dispute with Beijing over a group of uninhabited islands in the East China Sea. The two main Palestinian factions, Fatah and Hamas, have announced a reconciliation deal, saying they will now try to form a unity government in the coming weeks. Hamas Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh said, "We declare this good news, the end of the years of the division of our Palestinian people in their homeland and in the diaspora." Hamas and Fatah split violently in 2007 and have since divided their people between two sets of rulers. Both the U.S. and Israel condemned the agreement. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Wednesday accused Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who is also known as Abu Mazen, of sabotaging peace efforts.
We're trying to relaunch the negotiations with the Palestinians. Every time we get to that point, Abu Mazen stacks on additional conditions, which he knows that Israel cannot give. So instead of moving into peace with Israel, he's moving into peace with Hamas. And he has to choose. Does he want peace with Hamas or peace with Israel? You can have one, but not the other.
Israel, the United States, and the European Union consider Hamas a terrorist group. Adding to the tensions, an Israeli airstrike hit the northern Gaza Strip, home of Hamas, soon after the reconciliation announcement. Palestinian officials said the strike wounded 12 people, all of them civilians.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Officials from around the world are meeting this week to discuss protecting the world's oceans amid climate change and overfishing. The Global Oceans Action Summit for Food Security and Blue Growth is being held in The Hague, and the summit runs through Friday. VOA's Joe DiCapua has our report.
Summit organizers estimate 40% of the world's population lives within 100 kilometers of a coastline. Nearly 700 million people live in low-lying coastal areas just 10 meters above sea level, and 13 of the world's 20 biggest cities are on the coast. What's more, up to 12% of the population relies on oceans for their livelihood. Netherlands Agriculture Minister Sharon Dijksma is chair of the Ocean Summit.
For most of history, man has had to fight nature to survive. In this century, he is beginning to realize that, in order to survive, he must protect it.
She says protecting the oceans is necessary, with global population expected to grow to 9 billion by 2050.
Are we really willing to stop the moral outcry that still almost 1 billion people go hungry to bed every day? Are we willing to stop the over-exploitation of our natural resources, especially fish stocks? We, as global leaders, ocean practitioners, businesses, scientists, NGOs, civil society and international organizations have to find answers to these questions the coming days.
Dijksma says that combined action and partnerships for healthier and productive oceans can drive sustainable growth and shared prosperity.
Let's face the facts. 80% of all life on the planet is found in the oceans. The ocean provides a global life support system that helps regulate climate and supplies half of the planet's oxygen needed for one in every two breaths that we take.
She says food security cannot be maintained without sustainable fisheries.
Fish contributes 17% of the animal protein consumed by the world population and thus is a critical source of food, with demand expected to double in the next 20 years.
The three major threats to ocean health are overfishing, habitat change, and pollution. However, Dijksma says efforts to eliminate these threats often have been unsuccessful. That failure, she says, contributes to tensions between growth and conservation. World Bank President Dr. Jim Yong Kim addressed the summit with a video message, saying oceans are fundamental to life. Kim says over the past decade, the bank has increased its support for fisheries, pollution reduction, and habitat conservation. In other words, support for what's called blue growth.
For example, we're working with Sierra Leone in Liberia to reduce illegal fishing and make catches sustainable. As a result, local communities have increased their catches by as much as 40%. In the Pacific, we're partnering with several countries and regional agencies to support smart limits on tuna fishing, which could increase local revenues by $250 million each year.
Also addressing the conference was Arne Mathiesen, the Food and Agriculture Organization's Assistant Director General for Fisheries and Aquaculture.
There are many good reasons why we need to push the blue agenda forward. The health of our planet itself, our health and food security, depends on how we treat the blue world. We cannot keep using marine and aquatic resources as if they were endless. And we cannot keep using our oceans as a waste pool.
He says oceans are rapidly losing biodiversity. Many regions report a sharp rise in invasive species, threatening local marine life. He says FAO programs aim to strengthen local fisheries to better manage and maintain fish stocks. Mathiesen says countries, agencies, and organizations at the summit need first to commit and then to act. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Connie Marrero, the oldest living professional baseball player, has died in his native Cuba at the age of 102. His grandson Wednesday confirmed the death, which came just 2 days before Marrero's 103rd birthday. Manuel Gallego in Havana is a longtime fan of the famed pitcher. He said it's a sensitive loss because he was a living legend of Major League Baseball and also for baseball in Cuba before the revolution. Connie Marrero played ball in the United States where he pitched baseball games with a renowned control of presence. Everyone liked him. Diminutive, they said, not too terribly tall. One other thing to note, former Romanian tennis champion Ilina Stasi. Well, he's back. You wonder where he's been? Well, he's running for parliament. The one-time bad boy of tennis announced on Wednesday that he will stand in the Bucharest by-election for a seat in the Romanian Senate. Nastasi, who is now 67 years old, will be a candidate for the Conservative Party, a small group that is part of the left-leaning governing coalition. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. Good to have you with us. You know, you can also find us on the internet at voanews.com. And we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. According to tradition, on this date in 1479 BC, Thutmose III ascended to the throne of Egypt, although he shared power at first with his mother. During his reign, Thutmose created the largest empire Egypt had ever seen. Also, according to tradition, this is the date in 1184 BC when the Greeks entered Troy using the Trojan horse. The story goes that after a fruitless 10-year siege, the Greeks constructed a huge wooden horse and hid fighters inside. When the Greeks pretended to leave, the Trojans dragged the horse inside their city, which was then destroyed when the hidden troops emerged. In 1704, the first regular newspaper in America, the News Letter, was published in Boston, Massachusetts. In 1877, the last of the federal occupying troops withdrew from Louisiana, thus ending the period of Reconstruction in the occupied southern U.S. states following the Civil War. As a result, white Democrats came to rule the region, and black Southerners saw their rights steadily decline. In 1916, the Irish Republican Brotherhood started a rebellion in Ireland. The demonstrators wanted to end British rule in Ireland and establish an independent Irish Republic. In 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope was launched from the Space Shuttle Discovery. The telescope was named after the astronomer Edwin Hubble. The telescope has since taken spectacular pictures of the universe. In 2005, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger was inaugurated as the leader of the Roman Catholic Church, taking the name Pope Benedict XVI. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly supports Ukraine as the government there works to establish security and stability, pursue democratic elections and constitutional reform, revive its economy, and ensure government institutions are accountable to the Ukrainian people. To demonstrate the United States' commitment, President Barack Obama announced a new assistance package totaling $50 million to help Ukraine pursue political and economic reform. Constitutional reform and free and fair elections are keys to Ukraine's democratic development. The U.S. is contributing $11.4 million to support the integrity of the May 25th elections. These efforts include voter education programs, transparent election administration, election security, and a balanced media environment. The U.S. has already signed a $1 billion loan guarantee to help Ukraine meet its financial obligations and protect vulnerable citizens from the impact of economic adjustments. The U.S. has also supported Ukraine's work with the International Monetary Fund to secure a loan program worth $14 to $18 billion. Over the coming weeks, teams of U.S. experts will travel to the region to help Ukraine meet immediate and longer-term energy needs. A U.S. team has already arrived in Kiev to help Ukraine secure reverse flows of natural gas from its European neighbors. The United States is committed to helping Ukraine break its cycle of corruption that acts as a tax on business, an impediment to economic growth, and a drain on public trust. To further strengthen ties between the peoples of Ukraine and the United States, the U.S. is announcing its intent to establish a new bilateral visa regime that will extend the standard validity of visas for business people and tourists from 5 years to 10 years. In addition to the $50 million package, the U.S. is providing $8 million of non-lethal military assistance to allow Ukrainian armed forces and state border guard service to fulfill their core security missions. As Vice President Joe Biden told the Ukrainians on his recent visit to their country, "You will not walk this road alone. We will walk it with you."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials. Thank you.